Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the May 7th, 2007 session of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. We are in session. Today's meeting is going to be an informational meeting on the relationship of business incentives to economic development. And I'd like to thank everyone who made themselves available on a rather short notice to talk to us about that subject. I'd like to call up a panel of, Bob Repine, Mike Salzgiver, Tim McCabe, and Art Fish. We're going to have you up as well, and I don't know if everybody can fit in at the same time, so maybe one of you can stand by here in the front row or whatever.
Put Mr. Fish in the batter circle.
In the queue there.
On deck.
Yes, sir. Who's in the hole? Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please proceed. It's your pleasure.
Okay. Chair Witt, Vice Chair Lim, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Economic Development Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. I'd like to thank you for inviting me here today to talk about this very important subject, I believe. And I hope I understand what we're trying to get at here. I want to talk a little bit later about the incentive programs and the certified project ready sites and the return on investment that we've received as a state, because I think sometimes that's overlooked. So we oftentimes look at the expenditures but not the return on those expenditures. So I want to spend a little time talking about that. As you know, since taking office, the governor's focus has been to create jobs for Oregonians. During my time on the governor's staff and beforehand, we have worked to maintain a positive economic development climate that has seen Oregon become the fifth fastest growing economy in the country. As you are well aware, we live in an extremely competitive global economy. The scope of this global environment is intense and knows no borders. The state is in competition with those that are able to invest significant resources towards economic development projects and activities. We're working on a project right now, and Charlie Alcox here from PGE, as is Steve Vincent from Avista. This project is looking at a site in Oregon. It's also looking at a site in Singapore. It's looking at two sites in Europe. And the incentives that we have to offer pale in comparison. So I'd like you to keep that in perspective as we talk today. Recognizing the state's limited resources, we are not able to match the levels of investment that other states and countries like China are making. To compete and succeed in this global environment, the state must be smarter, more innovative, and work harder than our competition. To this end, state agencies like the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department have worked to develop innovative ways to market our state and use our resources to maintain a strong economic agenda that retains and expands existing companies and jobs, as well as recruits new investment to Oregon. Mr. Repine and his staff will discuss this in greater detail, specific business incentive programs, and the relationship to economic development. We believe that Oregon can compete and succeed in this global environment and bring family wage jobs to the state. However, to do so, we must be innovative in our approach and use our limited resources to the best advantage. If not, there is little chance for the state to compete in the global marketplace. In conclusion, the business incentive programs that we will be discussing in greater detail today are important tools that raise Oregon's profile and provide the state with the ability to compete in a highly competitive global economy. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to provide the committee with comments on this issue and would be willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. And what I may do is have the panel go through your statements before we open it up for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development. I want to follow up on Mr. McCabe's comments. Clearly, as you heard in Tim's comments, we are, and obviously most of you, as you pick up a newspaper or see anything in the news, the world is flat. And it is a very, very dynamic, very competitive world that we live in. because of that competitiveness, we participate as all jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, state jurisdictions, federal, other country jurisdictions, in trying to find the right incentives that are available to use as enticements or as tools to help businesses located in the state of Oregon. Because of the economy going very cyclical, as you know, over time, we've just recently come out of a period of investments in Oregon that, through the leadership of this governor and through the work of this agency, we have been very successful in landing many businesses over the last few years. My belief is because of our presence in the Pacific Coast, our presence to the country of California, that geographical locations, there are other prominent opportunities, and I didn't make a mistake when I said country of California. there are many opportunities, still opportunities for Oregon to be successful in recruiting, and I might add, expanding businesses. In the agency, if you remember when the session started, if you remember back those months, I presented to you some information through a pamphlet that we have our strategic planning process. And one of our goals in our strategic plan has been, and was stated in that document, is promoting a favorable investment climate to strengthen business, create jobs, and real wages for those jobs. And I think it's still very important for the state of Oregon and this agency to be very focused on that type of activity to make sure we are making the right investments in a very strategic way to create those business opportunities in Oregon. Those investments are more found or articulated by saying we invest and engage in training and a skilled workforce, using resources to help facilitate that. We have programs, business programs, to retain and expand existing companies and also recruit new businesses. And we also want to keep our shop running in a way that we can capitalize our competitive advantages, strategic investment resources, and to offset any disadvantages we might have. Every state and anybody's in this competitive world has its strengths and has its weaknesses, and we need to be able to take advantage of our strengths and play down our weaknesses that we might have in Oregon. One of the other things that I think we need to think about is when we talk about investments, incentives, a lot of it is just capital investment that we do with our staff. We have 12 business development officers that are located in the state of Oregon who are out there to work on behalf of businesses, both current Oregon businesses, to give them information and technical assistance on how do they expand their businesses, how can they be more productive in their business work. At the same time, they are available to inbound businesses who are trying to find locations to locate and to find what attributes of that community would be of value to them. And so we do play a very big role in just technical assistance relative to incentive. And so I think sometimes we don't think about that as an incentive, but I think one of the pieces of information that I've been shared with in the last few months is that businesses who have located here have been very complimentary about the approach that we have taken as a state to give them and help them get the information they need to make a business decision. We do it in a timely fashion. We do it with all voices speaking the same way through the governor's economic revitalization team efforts, better known as ERT, and we are able to give answers in a very concise fashion to them. And that's been very appreciative and very positive for the businesses who are contemplating Oregon locations. We also, as I mentioned before, we have a series of investment tools that we use. As Tim mentioned, too, not probably as robust as many other states. I'm sure there's other people who don't have as much as we do, but probably our most substantial investment that we have is our Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund. This is really kind of money that's available to be able to close the deals in appropriate fashions. And I would also tell you that every one of our incentive programs are tied with clawback provisions. We, as a state, take advantage of the opportunities we have to have resources available, but at the same time, we don't leave any money on the table without protecting the interest of those funds. Usually the way a strategic reserve fund is developed is based on the number of jobs that either the company will be expanding to, if it's a current company in Oregon, or the number of jobs they will be creating in Oregon. It's based on a stabilization period, of which they have then 8 quarters or 2 years to show us that they've created those jobs at those levels, at those numbers of levels, plus the incomes of those jobs. And if they don't, then they're subject to a predetermined return of resources to the state of Oregon. So it's never put out there as money just that you can have, and you don't have any obligation to live up to. We have obligations. We expect deliverables at the end of the day. Again, we have money that we'll invest in workforce development with our company partners. We have a series of business development tax incentives that Mr. Fish will be talking to you in a little later time. More prominent, the ones you've probably heard, are the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, better known as BETC, the SIP programs, and the Enterprise Zone programs. Again, Oregon is competing against states and nations around this world. We work with our local partners to figure out what's the best business opportunities that might be available that they're looking for to enhance their communities, either by expanding those current businesses there or trying to find a business that needs to be brought in that fits the nature or the network of businesses that are already in their community today. Many of you have heard the terminology of cluster industries. Many industries now are thinking in that way, and we are working in that way to deliver cluster opportunities. So you might find a community that has five trades that can work in a very succinct way, but they're lacking one other trade business opportunity that, if it was there, would change up much of their deliverables at the end of the day for the community. And we'll work with that community to find that sixth business, so we can bring that sixth business in to make that a full cluster industry opportunity so they can be successful on a continuing basis. Again, small applications of our contributions, but each one of those adds to the incentives that we put together in Oregon. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions.
Thank you very much.
No testimonies.
Testimony at this point. Okay, questions or comments for our panel? Yes, Representative Bowlby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, gentlemen, on a Monday morning. It's tough coming here with the beautiful weather outside. But this is really an important subject, and I know Mr. Repine has heard me say this before, but I always have and great concern, and maybe Mr. McCabe's never heard this one before, but I always have great concern when we have all these economic development dollars, and a lot of them always involve construction, and it really frustrates me to see the construction pieces go to out-of-state contractors who import their labor, pay them far below what is an area standard or even close to a living wage for that industry in this state. And I see that happen in enterprise zones. I see it happen with, the governor's strategic investment funds. And I point to Lowe's yet again for that. And I understand that. I don't know where the current project in Albany. I think that's is that a Pepsi project. Much the same scenario looks like it's going to happen there. And it just happens time and time again. And these construction dollars leave our state, and oftentimes the imported workforce ends up being left behind and becoming yet another burden to our revenue system. So I don't know what the solution to that is, short of, requiring prevailing wage on all projects that use economic development dollars. But one of my greater concerns is as we've witnessed or heard in this committee, has been around the shortage of skilled workers we have in this industry. And if we don't start getting more apprentices in the queue in this state, our state's economy is going to suffer in the future. And so this whole system of watching our contracts go to out-of-state contractors that use an out-of-state workforce that have no investment in Oregon and, in fact, are taking jobs away from potential slots that we could be training our workforce for the future seems to be a real disconnect to me. And so I don't know if this is an ongoing discussion I'm going to continue to have with you, but I want to work on a solution to that aspect of our economy, because construction is one of the, I believe, the third highest in high demand, high wage job occupations we have in this state.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, you made a very good point. I would like to point out that we are, if you know Lita Colligan from our workforce development, the governor's workforce development policy advisor, we are working closely with unions now on apprenticeship programs. The problem we're faced is with the co-chair's budget, it's taken $10 million out of the governor's budget that was earmarked for that training. It left $5 million in around cluster training for our existing industries, but there is nothing in terms of the trade unions and training for them in that. However, that being said, we are still working with them to develop apprenticeship programs. And along those lines, we're trying to shorten those programs so that you can get that skilled workforce out there sooner rather than the long-term training programs that they currently employ.
Well, I'll follow up with that a little bit, and I know I'm familiar with the Skill Up program. I think you must be referring to that, because that went through this committee, and there is $1 million of that we did try to dedicate towards apprenticeship programs of that $10 million. But that's reliant on the corporate minimum tax, which we don't have one at this point in time. So I don't know what else. And then just to clarify that apprenticeship programs aren't necessarily union or non-union.
No, I
understand. There's plenty. I mean, they're of interest to the whole construction industry and to the interest of the state. They're really not just aimed at a union aspect to it.
I understand. I misspoke on that.
Anyone else? Yes, Representative Gerard.
Well, thank you, Chairman. I'd just like to comment a little bit on infrastructure and where you rate that as a priority, because for me that's kind of my top priority for the state, is always maintaining a good infrastructure.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Gerard, I think one of the very first meetings that I testified in front of you, I gave you my what did I think the future held for Oregon, and setting aside the current budget proposal that's out there by the co-chairs, where the agency's request for increased infrastructure resources has been, at this point in time, not moved forward. I think as we think about the growth of this state and where communities are now becoming cities that were just little road stop buildings along the side of the road, we need to realize that we have a huge, going to have a huge investment need for our infrastructures. Just saw it recently in my office Friday, a request coming in from one of our, what you would arguably think to be more of a metropolitan area, and in that request they were talking about the fact that this city, current city, has wood water lines still in place between the reservoir to the transmission lines. Now, you would think, as someone mentioned, would say wood, you think this is 100 years ago or somewhere else, some other country. And the reality is it's a very prosperous community in the Oregon marketplace today that has this wood transmission line. So we see the future of Oregon as it is today. The Oregon we know today is very reliant on infrastructure such as highways. And I think we've all agreed to that and subscribed to that. But we also have a mechanism that we have that pays for that. We have a fuel tax. Now, generally, Oregonians and we sitting in this room probably don't like paying our fuel tax either. But the reality is for every gallon of gas we buy, we get fuel tax. And we know that those pennies combined with your pennies and everybody else's pennies in this building puts a lot of money together to create the infrastructure for the highway system. Underlying much of that highway system or road system is sewer and water lines. It's an infrastructure, a little different. It doesn't carry cars. It carries other items. And it is just as valuable to, if we're worried about potholes in roads, broken water mains and failing sewer lines, and or clogged sewer lines, become just as much of a social issue or a human issue, a community issue as the roads. So I contend that the issues around infrastructure, because Oregon is at that point in its age right now where systems have been maintenance for years, repaired for years, but they're at that point where either they've got to be upsized to meet more demands, or the system is so poorly out of compliance with federal regulatory responsibilities for clean air, clean air issues, clear water issues, suspect more importantly, that cities and communities are having to pay tremendous amount of money. Or looking at tremendous fees to improve their capacity for the sewer and water. And I think it's going to hit the smaller communities probably worse than obviously the bigger ones, because the bigger ones have a bigger base of ratepayers they can divide this against. I was talking to one of your colleagues, Representative Butler, and I probably won't get the details right, but he was telling me of a community out in his area where the rates, because of the necessity to improve the sewer system and the number of ratepayers, caused their rates to go up to something like $120 a month for their sewer. Now, that's in a rural, you know, maybe in the metropolitan area you wouldn't think anything about it, but in a rural area, particularly the Burns area, you'd see that's a big problem. So I think infrastructure is going to be played out just like that time and time and time again in the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to give us some information that currently how many companies throughout the nations or any other countries willing to come to our state to try to invest or open their own companies, or how many companies located in our state try to move out to other state, and whatever reason it might be, and then could you give us a current status, what's the activity of the companies coming in and going out?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Lim, we can give you at least a number relative to the number of businesses that are in we're recruiting with at this point in time in the state of Oregon. Many times, unfortunately, we don't necessarily know about the companies who might be contemplating leaving Oregon. We have some heads up more recently, probably with the Freightliner one that was pretty public. Everybody knew that the end was coming. But that doesn't always happen with every company that, for whatever reasons, all they have to do is notify the Department of Employment to tell them that they'll be shutting jobs down within 90 days, and that's probably sometimes the only notice we get, too. But we can give you at least the status of the types or a gross number of companies that we are currently working on without necessarily divulging their names.
Okay, and another question.
Please, Vice Chair Lim.
I'm not sure how much is the governor's strategic investment program, investment funds. It's about $6 million. How much was it? $8 million?
It's just shy of eight.
Shy of eight, okay. And do you believe is that sufficient enough at this time? Always not enough, you know. But compared to Washington, California, any other state, how do they handle the situation? If some company coming in, they want some cash incentives, and then do you believe $8 million is good enough, or do we need to increase more? Or the comparison with the other state, where we are at this time? You can answer that question.
It's your boss.
Chair Witt, Representative
Thank
Lim.
You.
As you said, it's never enough money. I think we deploy those funds in a different manner than other states. You could look around and see some states. Michigan, it's a private sector led. It's a nonprofit that has millions, I'm talking tens of millions of dollars for just these purposes that's used much the same way. And that goes back to what I was talking about earlier. I think we have to be creative and very cognizant of how we use those funds so they're used for their best purpose. But absolutely, if we could have twice as much, we could do a lot more. But as Bob said, those funds are always, always watched very closely. The jobs that are connected with those, you know, are very important, and the wages and the skills are very important. So I hope that answers it. There's a lot of different programs out there, but I think Oregon's, the way we do it, is a good way to do it.
Okay, just one more question.
Please.
Labor cost is one of the big issues right now, and it's good to pay a family wage, high jobs, but at the same time, we need to look at the statewide, nationwide, worldwide competition. And so where we are at this time, the labor cost, and do you think currently still we are in the ball game, we can compete with any other state, or our state is in the middle or high and lower? What's the situation at this time? Because as I read this material given to me, labor cost is the number one issue trying to locate in our state.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, committee members, for the record, Mike Salzgiver, I serve as Deputy Director of the Economic Development Department. I don't have actual or specific numbers for you right off the top of my head, but I can tell you, having been on both sides of this equation, that Oregon's labor costs are perceived both nationally and globally as being on the high side of average. But there are other factors that help Oregon be competitive. And so, for example, our workers' compensation system related costs are by far and away one of our strongest competitive advantages right now. On the other hand, as is the case nationally, healthcare related costs and then direct labor costs are perceived to be on the high side as compared to other states. Direct labor costs, just total compensation that workers are paid, are generally seen as, again, on the slightly high side. If you connect that with particularly with publicly supported or publicly paid projects, the business community has expressed concern about those costs.
Okay. Just a small comment, Mr.
Please.
And we are known that the per capita incomes from nationwide, we are lower, and at the same time, the labor cost and plus other costs seems to me a little higher. I think that I just want to mention we need to watch how the balance out. So I just want to make that comment.
Representative Dolan?
I have a follow-up, Mike. With labor costs and higher than average, is that a regional situation in Oregon? Would that be Portland and the metropolitan area, or is that statewide when you talk about higher than average?
Chair Witt, Representative Dalem, I don't want to overstate higher than average. Again, not having the exact numbers in front of me, I want to kind of characterize it as slightly above average, and it is not equal around the region. The Portland metropolitan region is certainly probably much higher than the rest of the state, but I don't want to guess here. I think what we could do is work with the Employment Department and provide you with more specific data.
I think I know the answer. If I could, I'd like to ask Bob one question, if I could.
Please.
Bob, you and I were talking before the meeting, and we've talked several times before. If Intel or Google, I'm kind of in love with that. If Google were to come to the state today, could we cite them? Do we have a shovel-ready site?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Dolan, yes, we do. They would be somewhat limited where their location choices would be, but there are shovel-ready sites that would accomplish or accommodate a Google-type company, yes.
How about an Intel? Could we cite them?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Dolan, if it's on the scale of Intel as today, I would say we'd be hard-pressed to find a campus of that many acres together that would accommodate that type of facilities. That's not to say you couldn't start joining together properties or get them under one ownership to help facilitate that. Probably the largest tracts of land that would be accommodating a Google are found on the east side of the Cascades and more toward the Port of Morrow, Hermiston, LeGrand area, quite frankly, in the large tracts of land.
I was waiting for you to say Spray and Mitchell, but I guess you're not going to. Thank you, Bob.
I'm only familiar with the certified sites that are of that scale in the state right now.
Thank you, Bob.
Gentlemen. Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on Representative Lim's comments. I guess I'm a little confused, troubled, disturbed, I guess, maybe all of those, about the high cost of labor when we've heard that the state of Oregon's per capita income is one of the lowest in the nation. And, you know, and so I'm looking at this one particular report thinking that labor costs are the most important concern that corporations look at. And, I mean, we've heard testimony that really it was the availability of a skilled workforce was their first concern. And so we're getting different messages here, I think, than some of the things we've heard in this committee before. So I don't know how that equates the high cost of labor with the lowest per capita income and also the Oregon business plan. Not this session, but last session, Michael Porter from Harvard was commenting that, you know, one of Oregon's biggest economic challenges is creating higher wage jobs, that we need those higher wage jobs to really get our economy, you know, more self-reliant and more vibrant, that those higher paying jobs are extremely important to this. And this kind of makes you believe that, well, maybe our wages are too high and we need to go the other way. And it seems to me we need to be focused on bringing higher wages to Oregon and not inferring that our wages are too high already.
Chair Witt, Representative Holby, if I could respond to that. I think I might have opened a bit of a Pandora's box, but I want to make sure that I'm characterizing this properly here. By characterizing what I know of the business community's concerns about Oregon's labor cost, I don't want that to mean that in their list of issues that affect their business decisions, that is at the top of their list. I hear that, but I don't hear it at the top of the list. It's one factor that Oregon is measured by. By far and away, the biggest issue we hear about today and we've heard about for the last 3 or 4 years is having a skilled and trained workforce. Director Repine and I just met with the leadership of Freightliner about a month and a half ago in the wake of their announcement on, which frankly their announcement was not a surprise to us. They've actually told us several years ago, based on federal CAFE standards, what they were going to do here, and they followed through on that. But in talking with them, one of the things that they brought out right away was to paint the competitive picture for us, at least as far as that part of the manufacturing community is concerned. And Mr. McCabe pointed out the global economic challenges that we're facing. Freightliner is a classic example of that. We had a situation there where a community or a state in Mexico was willing basically to build that company a city to come in and locate their manufacturing and distribution facilities closer to an emerging key market for them. And so Mexico did that. And they basically gave them, although the company chose to pay for it, they were willing to give them 700 acres of land for this distribution facility and to site this area. One of the other factors cited by Freightliner's leadership, though, in terms of evaluating further additional significant investment in the United States versus in other countries, was both the quality and performance of the workforce. In Mexico, the workforce performs, their labor costs are substantially lower than in the United States. Their quality was of equal or slightly higher performance quality, and their absentee rates were 1% compared to the United States 18%. And so when we hear those kinds of numbers, that's what we work with the governor's office, with our colleagues in the employment division, and our colleagues in the private sector to try to begin to figure out how to address that in the context of a long-term challenge. So I don't want to overstate labor costs per se as they relate, particularly as wages might evaluate that. As my colleague Mr. Fish pointed out and can expand upon, there's earned income versus non-earned income that helps compute all of those numbers. But in the broader macro picture, there are a list of things that companies look at that are specific to their sector, and the big things we hear about right now are trained and skilled and available workforce and readily developable land. And in a state as small as Oregon, we have to maximize as much as we can those competitive advantages that we do have, and the dollars that we have in other programs leverage on those advantages, hopefully to bring the state home as far as being competitive for investment.
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. Could you please kind of elaborate on the need for higher ed and community colleges as far as graduates and the need for the workforce to be current?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative, I think clearly, and it speaks actually to what Representative Holley was talking about, this discussion that was held at the Oregon Business Conference with the representative from Harvard. We need to do a better job of creating both community college level skilled up people and university level people, and also have a place for them to do business in Oregon. I think many of you and myself have said, you know, we've done a great job of educating Oregonians and other people who come to Oregon, and they leave Oregon and take those skills elsewhere. And that's a huge investment that they're making, but a huge investment the state of Oregon is making at the same time, and we don't get the benefits of much of that investment that they've earned. So creating a better environment, I think we're seeing, I think, the results of some of this work of the Oregon Business Group, where we've said, look, universities and business need to work closer together. I think a byproduct or a product of that in front of this assembly is the Oregon Innovation proposal. You have four of your colleagues, two on the House, two on the Senate, have spent a tremendous amount of time trying to take the directive that you all gave them and said, look, go outside of this building, sit down with some of the most certified smart people in the business, figure out what we need to do to be leaders in industry opportunities, utilizing our university systems and finding economic opportunities through types of jobs or job creations where there's a commonality of a product that we can be the leader of, we can create the jobs, we can create the beginning of a new opportunity for economics in Oregon, as opposed to having it done over on the East Coast at other campuses, other university systems, and we get to see some of that dribble and drab into Oregon, but we're not the leader of it. And so I think clearly, if you follow the business conference logic that's been out there, and I believe it's true, a relationship with university level and business is paramount. We're seeing the results of that. I think ONAMI is a great example of some successes. The proposals that you find in the Oregon Innovation package are great examples of getting into that relationship between economic opportunities, good-paying jobs, high-paying jobs, and well-educated people. I think it also tees up our community college system. We know, and I think I've made this speech to you before, but the speech is we know there's going to be a lot of us leaving the workforce, and we need to have, because we're retiring, over 400,000 Oregonians from 2000 to 2014 are leaving the workforce. That means there's some opportunities for other Oregonians, and they need to learn skills. They need to learn even the skills that you find in a community college product programs, technical skills, that might give them a better job, a better paying job, but it might also tee them up to go to a university system over time. And so those become, I really believe, key pieces of economic viability and success in Oregon in the long run. Our K-12 system fits right in there, too. We need to be able to position our graduates to get ready for college to know that they have a job opportunity or a business opportunity that resides in Oregon. And if they're not going to be college-bound, can we get them to community college opportunities where they can learn technical opportunities to give them well-paying jobs? And if they're not going to go either one of those routes, how do we get them prepared to a workforce that starts filling the void that's going to be coming about because of the retirees that are happening in the state of Oregon? So I would say to you, Representative and other members, education right now is probably the most paramount thing that we could be investing in the state of Oregon as it pertains to the economic future of Oregon for those next generations.
Gentlemen, could you talk a little bit about incentives for business retention and assistance that we might be able to offer employers who on occasion may need a helping hand, who have, over the long term, been good corporate citizens, have provided jobs, have provided a tax base, have been integral partners in the local community in terms of civic events and helping to sponsor social components of the community. When a company finds itself in a bind and needs a helping hand, could you tell us some of the things that the state can offer?
Chair Witt, I think I'm the punt return specialist today, so I'm going to catch that one. If you look at the economic ecosystem of business retention and expansion in particular, there's a number of factors that go into a business's conditions that lead them to want to stay here and grow here. First and foremost, I think, is just knowing that the business climate of the state is positive and receptive to their particular enterprise. Second, I think we've touched on the big one, is having a ready supply of skilled workers, available workers that are here and ready to go. The other competitive advantages, the basic competitive advantages in Oregon, are relatively low-cost energy, although those costs are beginning to escalate over the last few years, a readily developable supply of land, and the governor and the legislature have worked together to position the state much better than it was even 4 or 5 years ago on that front. But then after that, there's then the education system. Those are the biggies. The state, interestingly enough, is perceived to have a pretty favorable tax climate, although it's relative between sector and industry types. So if you're in a high capital industry, Oregon is always a challenge. If you're in a low capital expenditure industry, sometimes it's perceived to be a little bit better, although local taxes can then impact that. So the tax climate, on balance, Oregon is recognized as having a competitive tax climate. When you get down to the specific business retention or expansion strategies, then the question becomes, what is the financial picture of that particular business? Let's look at, there was recently some question, for example, about Louisiana Pacific. They made a decision to relocate their headquarters to the south after being headquartered in Oregon for some length of time. That was, for all intents and purposes, a market-based decision. They had to go where their markets were. Fact of the matter is very little that we could do to keep them here. There wasn't an incentive program that really mattered to them in that front. Other companies, if their basic financial picture is weak, we can offer them on occasion some minor financial assistance. We used to have a fairly robust business retention fund. We no longer have much in the way of that. We have $350,000 to last us for 2 years, and that goes pretty quickly. We have another fund called the Industry Sector Outreach Fund, and you'll hear more about these when Mr. Fish comes up. But that's another one where we can use that to target specific businesses. But again, it's a fairly minor amount of money, and we have to spread it around. So in terms of actual discretionary funds that the director has available or the staff has available to us, it's really pretty minor. So then we get into other non-financial means, such as technical assistance or consulting through our small business development centers and other things. And that's really about the bottom line. For the larger companies, you know, there are like the Intels of the world or pulp and paper community or others in the manufacturing community. There are programs that are designed to address their specific needs because the legislature recognized the relative economic value of those sectors to the state. But by and large, it really does get down to a one-on-one, staying in touch with the businesses, initially through our business development officer network, also leveraging with our private sector partners and our sister agencies, and just staying in touch with them and hearing what they've got going. And if there's a specific challenge, we try to sit down with them and work on that. One other thing I'd point out is Oregon is gaining a dramatically improved reputation with respect to regulatory processes. The amount of work that's been done on that front in the last 4 years in particular, people are taking note of that.
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up to Mike's comments, I think the other piece is interesting. Myself and Mr. McCabe were in a conference last week in Denver where it's the national, it's called Cornet, which is where all the national and actually international site selectors meet. These are the individuals who are hired by corporations to help them find future business opportunities. They're the ones that we, in many cases, work with on a one-on-one basis. One of the interesting assets that we have in Oregon today, and I'm very proud to tell you, say this to you, is our governor. He participated about 4 years ago in a Cornet event with Mr. Salziger in Las Vegas, and had a breakfast in the morning. He did a one-on-one kind of meeting with many of the site selectors. He is known as a governor that actually is involved in economic development, and we're envied by many states that we have a governor who's willing through as Mike talked to you about tracking and working one-on-one with these companies. Sometimes it just takes that little extra phone call for the governor just to call that company and say, you know, we talked to you 6 months ago. Want to know if there's any more decision, anything else I can do to help you. That type of influence or that level plays a tremendous role in our success. People still talk about the breakfast that our governor was in Las Vegas with them to talk about the importance of economic issues. We're seen as a state with a governor who gets economic development. And, you know, it may not be an incentive in the same sense of finances, but, well, I'll tell you what, I'll take that kind of governor versus a governor who is disengaged from the economic issues of his state. So we have an absolute opportunity, and we use that opportunity as much as we can to use that to leverage businesses as we come to Oregon.
Please, Vice Chair Lim.
My concern is in the future at this time, as we... looking at the Senate Bill 838 concerning the renewable energy in 2025, we need to have a green energy, a 25% increase, which is all known fact. And we will be moving that direction anyway. But I got a call from the many big companies like Boeing, others. This is not good beer. Because the automatic rate adjustment might put them into more, costing them to pay more higher energy. What do we see in the future? Currently, our state enjoy plenty of water and lower rate of electricity. And with this bill, 838 passes, chances are it's going to go up. And they are deeply concerned. Do we have any plan? How are we going to work out in the future when they look at our state? Oh, Oregon is very green and possibly higher energy cost. And what is our plan in the future? Who can answer that question?
Representative Lim, Chair Witt, members of the committee. It's a very good question. It's a very good point. It's something the governor really strongly considered before he proposed it. But when you talk about energy prices in Oregon today, they're much lower than most other states. There's a few, Idaho, portions of Washington, that are lower, not significantly lower. So if you look at the long-term plan and his goal at 2025 and the industries we're trying to attract, you may remember some weeks ago we brought Solar World in. That's a partnership between the utility because they're heavy electrical users. We're talking another heavy electrical user. We're going to take advantage of Oregon's low, and I think Mr. Alcock will probably touch on this later, but the low energy prices we have today encourages businesses like that to locate in Oregon. Alan Alley and myself are developing a plan around the solar industry to attract those industries to Oregon, which in turn raises the wages, the Oregon wages, because they pay significantly higher. The problem we're faced with, again, and it's like Representative Holby said, we don't have a skilled workforce. We have to train these people. We have to partner with these companies coming in. You know, it behooves us to do this because, as I stated earlier, this one company we're talking to is looking at Singapore and two sites in Europe, and their incentives are much higher. But what we do have to offer today is Oregon's commitment to their products. As Bob said, we're right next to the one of the largest countries in the world. I mean, it's the ninth largest economy in the world, and that's where these solar panels are going to go. It's cheaper to build them here than down there. And there's no reason that once we do this and attract those industries, that those installations and wind generation, all of that, that Oregon can't be known as the alternative energy capital of the United States. And I firmly believe that we can keep our power rates down below the national average, even with the governor's incentive. And I'm quite proud that Oregon's looking this way, to be a leader in renewables.
Thank you very much. I hope your prediction is correct in the future.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, if I could amplify on that a little bit. Also, in 2005, the other Senate Bill 838 was what created the Oregon Innovation Council. And when the legislature created that council, it charged that group with coming forward with an innovation plan within a very short period of time. That plan was delivered last September to the governor and to the legislature. That has led to a $38.2 million recommendation package, that of which advanced energy development is a centerpiece. And so if you look at solar, if you look at biofuels, if you look at wave energy, if you look at supporting renewable across the board, if you look at green construction, which is a very large and emerging competitive advantage for the state, we're beginning to export our knowledge in those areas already. Interestingly enough, in the biofuel area, the recruitment interest is such that we're actually ahead of the legislative process right now, where we have a situation where there are a number of companies that are interested in locating here, and we already have refineries beginning to grow around the state. So I think the Innovation Council has highlighted that area as a strong competitive advantage through the Brand Oregon program, which is where we help brand and market the state in our high economic return areas. You'll see more about those sectors in the months to come.
Thank you.
I was wondering if our state has an early warning system that would indicate employers that that may be in need of help. Could potentially be embarrassing for employers to make an adverse situation known. It could be contrary to their own economic interests. If word were to get out, potentially suppliers start demanding cash on the barrelhead, and leads to a number of other adverse problems. There may be some reticence then for employers to step forward and ask for assistance, but the employer, the state, the workforce, everyone might be well served if we were able to proactively approach different enterprises that need assistance. How do we determine who might be in those positions?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think the answer to that is really relies much on the communities that these businesses are located in. I think as all rumors or concerns are usually you can find them on the streets and communities, or at least it's the talk of the coffee shop, if nothing else. That local representative or partnership that we have with the community then gets lifted to our business development officer, where we then make a contact with the company, too, trying to be as discreet as possible. You and I talked about one, Mr. Chair, which I won't name, where we had that exact issue happen in a rural part of the state of Oregon, where a company was in a losing $1 million, and it was a company that couldn't ill afford losing $1 million based on their margins. But because we heard about the problem, we knew that the employees were working with the company too to try to figure out if there was a role they could help to assist the company. We were able to get information that from the company what their issues are today, what they were trying to get accomplished in the near future to keep their doors open, and what do they see as a long-term solution that would really change the whole dynamic of their business. We did an assessment on that, and we participated with them just as much as the employees have taken a discount or reduction in their pay scale. Those are found at the grassroots levels. So there isn't a 1-800 number where they can call in. I think what you do is companies, as you know, Mr. Chair and other members, companies that will try to work it out as long as they can, as best they can, until maybe they get to the point where they just throw their hands up and they quit. I believe reliant on the local information system, you know, trying to find out from somebody that's a local economic person or a company that's in that area that has an interest or issue of concern about a company maybe going out of business will contact us. It's a pretty interesting chain of communications. What we usually find out about these companies in many cases, not always, but in many cases where they're having some difficulties, and we do everything we can to circle back and offer them tools. But it's not a posting on an email. It's not a 1-800 number or anything of that level. Maybe it'll get to that point sometime, but at this point I don't think it is.
Thank you. I'm just curious roughly how much money we might spend as a state on an annual basis, ballpark figure, attracting new companies.
Chair Witt, we don't have a budget. We put it within the governor's budget. We had put $2.1 million for the brand Oregon. And what that was earmarked for was business recruitment, trade shows, even some trade missions were built into that figure, but that was taken out of the co-chairs. In the past, 4 years ago when Brand Oregon started, I believe, and Mike, you correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had $500,000.
That's correct.
$500,000, which really isn't a lot of money, you know, when you're out there talking about business recruitment, because you can't really advertise. So it was $250,000, and we partnered with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Association, Oregon Economic Development Association. They raised matching funds to take it up to $500,000. We targeted specific trade shows around industries we were trying to attract to Oregon. We did a targeted campaign in Northern California because energy prices were so high at the time, and we felt like that was a good market. So, and we achieved a lot of successes. Amy's Kitchen, which you've probably heard about in Medford, was a direct result of those efforts. But at this point in time, we have no budget to actually go out and recruit.
Representative Dolan.
I'd like to go to the other side of that coin and talk with you a minute, Bob. I know that in my community, the epiphany came with Google. We changed from a depression climate to a booming climate. So I'm going to, and I know that there were many factors involved, so many that there's just about a factor for every person in town. But one of the big ones was shovel-ready sites. And so I'm going to ask Bob, what has been the return on investment for a city like the Dalles when Google comes?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, we have some information that actually I don't know if we've shared with you, but we can surely share with the committee staff that kind of talks about what we've invested in certified sites or the shovel-ready sites and what the actual return on investment has been there. And it's been a pretty amazing amount of money for the amount of money we've put in. It's tenfold, if I'm not mistaken. I want to say we put in something around $74 million, and the investments are close to $700 million in all these sites. So it has shown to be very significant. I think the other, you know, every business, not every business, but most businesses that locate, the one you're talking about in particular, that changes the community's opportunities at a level that we don't track. There are those intangibles that come along. There are companies, such as the one you're mentioning, who will locate somewhere and because of that, just because of that mere location or them announcing being there, there's a change or an in-migration of other businesses that will want to be in and around there to do other business with them, or have they have some indirect relationship with them. And so we become the benefactors of many, many, many businesses that come to Oregon because they have been attracted because of the, I guess I use it as the kind of the analogy that you use for shopping malls. You have anchor tenants, the larger boxes that you put at the end of a mall. They don't pay as much for square footage. It's all made up by the little shops in between because they want to be close to the larger anchor tenants, and they'll pay the larger square footage cost to make up for the differences. And so you get that even in this level of economic development. You have, I can clearly tell you that because of a company like Genentech coming to the Hillsborough area, there will be a series of companies that will come over the next year or two that will be directly related or have some indirect or direct relationship with a Genentech type of company that will come here just because Genentech. They won't come to us and ask for anything. They'll just come here, open up a business, hire people, create economic opportunities. So those are those second level, second, third level tiers of economic opportunities that come about in the state of Oregon because we landed at Genentech, but we don't necessarily track because they're very difficult to track when they come to communities. And you have all the other issues when you have a company like you're talking about coming to your community. Somebody's going to say, gee, I think it's time we have a Starbucks. I think it's time we have a New Life grocery store. All of a sudden, the whole dynamics of the community starts changing because you have the infusion of a whole new culture, in a sense, coming to a community that wasn't there before, and the demands and what they're looking for in the economies or the economics of that community may not be there. So somebody as a business person will say, okay, this is the type of people who would like this, therefore I will create that business opportunity for them. And so there are huge roll-up opportunities from just locating one company.
I think, Mr. Repine, you've described the Dells. Thank you.
I just have a couple of comments on some of our priorities, and I think that the legislature would be well served by taking note of some of the priorities that you have described here this morning, not the least of which is the importance of education in terms of economic and workforce development. I know early on in our committee, I remember Representative Dahlem's quote that to every problem that has come before our committee virtually this session relates to education, 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 was his quote. And I am disturbed by the relatively small amount of money that we are as a state contemplating funding post-secondary education. It was a week ago yesterday, I believe, that there was an article in the Oregonian that compared Oregon's workforce investment and investment in post-secondary education with that of the state of Washington. Arguably, their economy is significantly larger than ours based on Seattle and the ports, the port system there, but nonetheless, vastly outstripping what's under consideration here in Oregon. And we have been told in our committee that the average worker is going to expect to change jobs probably half a dozen or eight times in their working career. It's now become the norm. We've talked about repeatedly the importance of getting workers into the pipeline so that they are job ready to meet employer demands. Everything that we've talked about underscores the importance of funding education. And I am once again disappointed, not in what you've told us, but in our ability to be able to respond to what you have set as a benchmark for the state's performance in both economic and workforce development. I'm also left feeling that once again, and I've had employers tell me this over some period of time, that oftentimes they question how much they're valued and how much their contributions are valued by the state, and that it may be that they need economic assistance. It may mean that they're just that they're just shown appreciation, and certainly not not your fault. But if I take a look at the amount of money that you indicated is available in our business retention fund, I think the figure is $350,000, and compare that with the amount of money that we spend as a state on trying to attract new businesses. Certainly we're well served in spending as much money as necessary to attract those businesses. But I think that we're left with a very big disparity between what we spend on trying to get the new folks in and what we spend perhaps demonstrating how much we value employers that are already here doing the good things. And lastly, Vice Chair Lim has taught me a great deal this session about the importance of personal relationships in terms of trade and business. And I would like to see our state place renewed emphasis on establishing those kinds of personal relationships, not only in attracting the new business, but also in valuing the businesses that are already here. And Bob, your comments about how much it was appreciated that the governor made a personal appearance down in California, and that he made a personal telephone call to another business. I think that just underscores the importance that a lot of businesses place on the state developing those kinds of relationships. Further questions or comments from our committee? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up now, please, Art Fish, Steve Vincent, and Charlie Alcock, please. Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
All right. Chair Witt, members of the committee, again, it's my pleasure to be here for my first opportunity to testify this session on the House side. My name is Arthur Fish, Business Incentives Coordinator with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and the nod seemed to be saying that I should start. My job, I think, is more just to kind of give you some background on some more specific program level of some of the things that I deal most often with, which are more the tax incentives and taxes, and basically then just throw it open to questions that you may have to that. But the first thing I just offer is, on the short notice, we just worked with stuff we had available, which is stuff from, a lot of this is from my workshop presentations, which I will give to practitioners. A lot of our tools really, they're all done in concert with local governments and local organizations in efforts really both for retention, expansion, and, these more sort of, interesting to talk about, but not necessarily the whole picture type of thing with Design LLC or Genentech, or Design LLC is the term I'll use for Google. Now on the fourth slide on the bottom of the second page is sort of a summary, and this is how I kind of provide it, that I think you heard from the first speakers. And, the competitiveness of the companies that want to work here, that are here, is a big factor. The startup costs for reinvestments, and especially greenfield investments, are very high. The risk and costs are very high, and that's where a lot of these incentives come in, is at the front end when we're trying to help a company make that next move. And, again, we're often working with companies that are here. They may be here, they may be somewhere else, too, and it's a question, where do they want to expand? These sort of global competitions come along once in a while, but usually we're competing, if we are, with sort of alternatives, and they're not always parallel You know, companies might do something, you know, in San Diego. They might do something here. They're going to, not exactly, but they do the same thing. And so you get into a lot more, you know, when you're out there in the real world, it's a lot less, you know, clear than they sort of, you know, we're fighting for, you know, company A to do X, and it's all that simple. But, you know, the companies are looking to limit some of their risk, and, you know, we're generally focused on companies engaged in the traded sectors. Okay, these are companies that are not in the retail, sort of, you know, competing locally. These are companies that are trading goods and services, at least across state lines, if you will. Or at least they're in competition with such companies that may import into Oregon. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, build up those communities with value-added types of activities. And these are also the sectors that pay better. And so that's part of it. And the return, whether it's, you know, I mean, there's a huge infusion if you get a new investment as far as, you know, dollars spent up front to create a new facility or to expand a facility, and that's always a big part. Our programs tend to focus more on the longer-term job creation and, you know, the jobs that will actually work at the facility or re-establish facility for some time. And so I take you to the third page, and here I've sort of divided, and this is sort of what I will tell my audiences, is if you look at sort of the competitive incentives out there, you know, tax abatements are a big part, and they come in a couple various varieties depending upon the tax systems in a place, and there is, you know, enormous diversity. One of the things that is kind of arising, is becoming more common, are payroll-based incentives along the lines of House Bill 2779, which, you know, came out of this committee. You're not alone as far as trying to focus things away from just, you know, investment tax or tax credits or something, but more geared to those parts of the economy that aren't tied strictly to major capital investments but have, you know, a lot of well-paid people, but maybe a fairly light load as far as what they put into bricks and mortar. Discretionary cash awards would fall into the category of the Strategic Reserve Fund. And I would just differentiate tax abatements, at least in Oregon, as being very programmatic. Our Constitution and pragmatic concerns tend to make these fairly programmatic. They can't necessarily be tailored to each and every situation. You set up a program, you have criteria. Often those criteria are geared towards something which is not going to necessarily help a business except with certain local waivers or exceptions that you see once in a while. But generally, they're geared towards companies that are going to do something new. Okay, they're going to expand. They're going to add jobs. Obviously, if they're new to the state in some way, that's not so hard to do. Now, with more discretionary cash awards, like the Strategic Reserve Fund or the Industry Sector Outreach and other things, which, you know, we may or may not have less or more money, you can obviously help sometimes the existing companies that just need to get over the hump to keep going. But, you know, again, a lot of times, you know, we want politically, as a matter of policy, to have jobs created. And so that's where sometimes, you know, these things are geared towards, but not necessarily by companies new to the state. I list here a bunch of things on the bottom slide of page 3, which do often come into play, like incentives in a more competitive sense, but they're also part of the backbone of how you make the area more ready. These are tools that are fairly common and recognizable from state to state or country to country. And, you know, with infrastructure and training and tax increment financing, and they're there and they help, but sometimes they go on day after day sort of making a climate better. Here on the next page, we talk about business costs. You know, energy is one of these things. It used to be huge, but we live in a less energy-intensive economy, to be sure. And sometimes you run into companies where the price of electricity is all important, and sometimes it doesn't matter. Other things that I think come up before taxes and tax incentives are these land and labor issues that you've been talking about. And then we get into issues of taxes and some of these other cost points that I mentioned here. And just to reiterate, Oregon does have a good tax climate. I don't think there's any question about that. Of course, you know, for certain companies, it, you know, can or can work out better. You know, we do have property taxes in the state, and if you're talking about the large investments, you do need that sort of capital cost relief, if you will, for some period of years. I mean, that's critical. And that's kind of where we are most competitive when we bring those incentives to bear. Oregon does have, of course, high personal income taxes, and those do have an effect on us in a sort of negative way in terms of labor costs and, you know, the cost of return to smaller entrepreneurs and stuff with capital gains. But generally speaking, it's a good tax climate. Our tax incentives, again, are, as I've noted, rather capital biased as far as being based mainly on property tax relief, which, you know, again, I don't want to say it's bad, but it is more or less what we have. Some of the tax credits on the state income tax side, can be used in other situations like the research tax credit, but, you know, even the business energy tax credit, which you'll find in these materials, is more geared towards capital. And I will stop with my workshop. I mean, this is sort of stuff, you know, you can look at. It next goes into some comparisons that I think other audiences and you may find very interesting as far as, you know, what some of our immediate neighbors do as far as taxes and tax incentives. Washington has a big sort of strategic reserve fund program that they've been kind of trying to get going here. They fund it fairly well, but I understand they're having a little trouble getting it to, you know, getting some of the kinks worked out as far as running it. I'd just like to make sure you understand these pieces. This one piece compares our various tax incentives, and I've gone through and isolated using the numbers in the tax expenditure report just to show how they stack up against all other tax expenditures as far as the property tax incentive programs, the enterprise zone programs, strategic investment, and then some of the tax credits that do matter for economic development. By tax credits and so forth, I mean income tax expenditures. So in here you can see on the last page is the property tax programs of enterprise zones and so forth. And one of the things, you know, I do this exercise is to show that, generally speaking, with these tax programs, we're in the neighborhood of 1% or much less of total tax expenditures or affected revenue year to year. So, I mean, I think it's important to bring that perspective, and that, you know, a lot of the other things that fill up that whole tax expenditure report don't necessarily have anything to do as incentives for economic development. This is a piece we recently developed. The first part shows. Now, we start here by looking at some of the numbers. If you take sort of a standard investment in capital in basically buildings and machinery equipment, and those are the things that get exempt under these programs. They're new, and they get exempt for 3 to 15 years, depending upon the program. Now, the first thing here is about $2.5 million investment. Well, just to give you an idea, most of the things that are going on in enterprise zones on a project level, about 70 or 80% of the projects are under that $2.5 million. We have a lot of small, obviously in many cases existing companies that are using this for some degree of benefit. Whether it makes a big difference or not, I don't know. But as you go up the scale and you talk about the fewer number of projects, but bigger projects that will tend to dominate the total amount of property that's being exempted, you can see the benefit is much more significant in dollar terms. And that's sort of what we find, and we do these, we run these numbers for companies to sort of give them an idea of how our programs compare in-state as well as what they might see elsewhere. And then on the back is just sort of a summary. I mean, I would just sort of summarize, first of all, our income tax programs is one, the single sales tax or factor is sort of a piece that has recently been done as part of our state income tax system, which has been very helpful for attracting the Genentechs and others who are coming here to make product, but not necessarily to sell that much, and thus their new investment and payroll doesn't change their income tax profile in Oregon. That's been very helpful. We also do have this Oregon Investment Advantage program. It hasn't been used materially yet, but we are signing up companies around the state more and more in rural areas. And this is the program that Representative Butler began, and it's an exemption from taxes. We can talk more about how that's different from these various credits on the backside, some of which, like Betsy, are not for economic development, to be sure. They're for conservation, energy efficiency, but they have proven to be very useful. And so I look at this chart and the tax expenditure report, and you can see some of these haven't had much use yet in terms of any cost to the system, if you will, but they all prove very attractive and very interesting to the companies we're talking to. So with that, you know, with that whirlwind of explanation, I'll let you let me explain things more.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thanks for inviting me to come up. Steve Vincent. I am with the Oregon Economic Development Association, and I also work for Vista Utilities, which is the electric and gas utility based in Spokane. We have gas service territory in southern Oregon. I want to take a few minutes today just to kind of explain where I've been the last several years in economic development and what the reality is. First, the Oregon Economic Development Association is really started as a peer exchange for local practitioners. You know, Scott Hagee from the Dalles and, you know, city and county employees, economic development agency employees who are the local infrastructure that the state has in place to do business recruitment, help local businesses with expansion as well as the retention side that you were asking about earlier. Over the last 5 years, I've been running around the country on behalf of my communities as well as the state doing business recruitment, whether it's at trade shows or meeting with corporate site selectors. And it's been pretty much all over the board from, you know, medical trade shows to, I was in Florida last year, for example, somebody saw my Oregon shirt and asked me what country I was from. And being in New York, they asked how bad is tornado season on us. So, you know, we're not quite on the map sometimes when it comes to some folks at the other end of the country. But we really have, I think, turned a corner. When I started attending trade shows for the purpose of trying to find businesses that are looking at expanding to another state or perhaps relocating their facilities, the common question was, I thought your governor said come but don't stay. And these were people who were about my age, who had to have been in grade school when Governor McCall made that statement. But they think that it's a recent statement. They think that it's something that has happened just in the last few years. But that comment has begun to change. And in cooperation with the governor's office and OECD, our association ran a marketing campaign from 2001 to 2004 that included earned media, media placement, trade shows. And I think that our state and that visibility that we are open to business, I actually experienced a drop-off in that question. And usually the question came from California-based companies, but a discernible change. And I'm not sure what influenced it. It's kind of hard to, you know, drive home to what exactly it was. But it's there. However, while we do have some incredible attributes in Oregon that help us with recruitment, we still have to be willing to negotiate. And I'll use the car lot analogy. You know, car lots that are fixed price don't usually sell cars. If you go buy a car, you expect to be able to negotiate. And those that say, nope, we don't negotiate here, regardless of the value and all of the attributes, you probably aren't going to go there. And I think that Oregon has to have, you know, the same willingness to realize that reality is that companies that are looking to site new facilities are going to ask that question. I provided you with three articles that were kind of timely to really kind of demonstrate the point. And the first was the this corporate survey that was done in August of last year. What I didn't give you was the rest of the, you know, sort of the mechanics of the survey itself. The respondents to this survey are corporate site selectors who are placing facilities all over the world. And yes, labor costs are the number one issue that they cite. And I think Mr. Salzgiver, you know, in mention of the Mexico offer. Another thing is these companies are obviously looking for, you know, the best location for their clients. And it's no, you know, it's not meant to be a judgment on our state of affairs here. But really what I wanted to point out in here is that fourth on the list is state and local incentives. And that companies are going to ask, do you have incentives? Because if you don't, then
I'm probably not going to include you in the list because I've got to represent my client, I've got to represent the company that I work for in the decision for site location. So that's one reality that I want to demonstrate to you. The second one is an article that just came out a couple of days ago, and I apologize as you're reading this. The second page was actually the backside of the title page on this article. So don't read the second page; you'll lose your way. But what's interesting about this article is that it's a tutorial for site selectors on how to leverage incentives out of states. Now, you might first react, well, gee, what are they doing to us? But what's interesting in these 10 negotiation strategies that the author wrote in, the second one is to demonstrate the benefits to the community. And in these companies that are looking to come and looking to, make best use of our incentives, at the same time realize they've got to be good corporate partners. That's not mine. And I think that they often, as far as my experience, the companies that are trying to negotiate for those incentives certainly do that. And I think Mr. Fish and the department have, that on-the-ground experience in the sales cycle and how that happens. The other thing that I provided just really quick was a list of state incentives, and I know that Mr. Fish has these as well, but the reason why I gave this to you, I know it's a busy article, but it lists the incentives that every state in the country has, including Puerto Rico. I think what it demonstrates is that this is a competitive environment. These are what states are offering. If we want to attract the investment, then this is what we've got to do. And I think that one of the things to realize, incentives are really an end game. They are what allow us to differentiate ourselves from the competition. I think that our state has been successful at that. The Cruise Line call center in Springfield is a great example. My company was trying to recruit it to Spokane, and my counterparts up there said, you guys just out-hustled us, and you had some incentives, mainly the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, that beat Spokane's effort to recruit that call center. And so again, it allowed Oregon to differentiate itself. And there is one other example, though, I'll give, and I wasn't involved in the Genentech project, but if I recall, Oregon was not going to be able to compete with Texas on how much incentive we could give, but we out-hustled the state of Texas. And we wanted it more, and we were successful in recruiting it for that reason. And just as many other factors as there are, people in Hillsborough, I'm sure. But I think it's a unique example that while we're not rich in incentives compared to other states, that sometimes we can still be successful just because of the effort that we make to recruit those companies. So I think I'll end it with really, again, my purpose in testifying was to just sort of give you the reality that this is what we have to work with, and if we want to attract those investments that I think as policymakers you should expect will give a return that exceeds the subsidy, and I think we have many examples of, Amy's Kitchen is a good one. We pulled that from a medical device trade show. The state's cost for that particular trade show was probably sending an employee, and the Economic Development Association actually sent people to that trade show on their own dime, but close to a $5,000 investment and 120 employees along with the company itself is an astronomical return, and hopefully we will continue to be able to demonstrate examples like that. If you have any questions for me, be happy to answer them. I hope that helps paint a picture.
Thank you very, very much, Steve. These are this is an exceptional handout. Thank you for providing that. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Lim, members of the committee. I'm Charlie Alcock, Economic Development Director for Portland General Electric. PGE places a very strong priority, very high priority, on the economic strength and vitality of the state and the many communities that we serve. And I'm here today in my capacity. I work very, very closely with the governor's office and with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the many economic development professionals throughout the state. And this is really, as the private sector member of this panel, I'm here to talk quite a bit about the public-private partnership that goes on to make economic development occur in this state and in our various communities. And I'd like to preface my remarks to really focus on the role of incentives, perhaps from the views that I have in working with the many projects, helping existing businesses, which are our customers, stay here in the state. We work very closely with them on many projects like that, and helping them expand here in our state, and then working with the communities on the recruitment projects that has gotten a lot of attention this morning. But really, the bread and butter for us in this business is really to focus on retaining existing businesses here and to help them expand. Many of the businesses that we do focus on are those businesses that Art Fish mentioned, are traded sector businesses. These are businesses that bring in new fresh dollars into our state and into our communities. One of the things that has struck me, and I'm on the board of the Utility Economic Development Association. It's a national trade association of people like myself that are economic development professionals at investor-owned utilities throughout the country, go to the various trade shows. I happen to be co-chair of the Oregon event at Cornet. Just in all of the watching of the industry that's going on now, one of the things that I can very clearly say is that this landscape is one of constant change, and it is always moving. And I think it's that world that we live in that provides the backdrop against many of the conversations that you're having today. Businesses are responding very quickly to changes in the global marketplace. We are seeing a very, very shortened time frame from the time a business decides to do something and from the time they want to be up and running, doing whatever it is they want to execute. It's not unusual to see businesses come to us with lead times of 3 to 6 months from the time they say they want to they see us and the time that they want to get up and running. That is a very, very big difference from what it was, say, even as short as 18 months ago. The other big difference that's going on is that the Internet and the information that is now available on the Internet has made it very, very difficult, and if you take on sort of the community or the state role, there are businesses out there looking at options, looking at their choices and what's available, information from workforce on sites and what are certified sites are, the economics, the demographics, the incentives that are available. They are all looking at that, and you don't know that we're being checked out. Because with the Internet, it's very, very hard. It's available information. So we tend to be at the very end of that, and we usually find out that these businesses, whether they're existing here today or whether they're studying us from afar, know far more about us than we know about them. And it's a process of having to come up to speed very, very quickly. Incentives availability, and we have a great repertoire that Mr. Fish has talked about, but it's really nothing more akin today than an open for business sign out on the Internet. And I'd like to perhaps have you think of it in that way. Every state has a whole different list. Every country, every region, there are different lists out there of incentives that are available. But it's really a community or a state's willingness to be open to business. And as I think Mr. Vincent talked about, Oregon's changing perception out there in the marketplace, and I think it's just another way of signaling our interest in being open for businesses, whether they're helping existing businesses expand, stay here, or for new ones that are coming. As businesses look at our state, and I think you could say that for any region, there's a broad list of things that they look at. Workforce availability of the right kinds of skilled workers, shovel-ready sites, infrastructure, whether it's transportation, water, sewer, or power, or natural gas, and the utilities are all requirements. And if these basic requirements aren't there, incentives don't make a bad fit really good. So in that sense, I think it's important for us to continue to stick with those basics. We're very blessed, and I get a chance to work with economic development professionals around our state every day. There is a mixing and matching of the various programs that are available, plus the basic factors, roads availability, sewer availability, sites availability, workforce. And you bring this portfolio of assets to the table. And it's a mix and match kind of an exercise. But I think as Oregonians, we ought to be very proud of the economic development team that we have in place that do that every day. And I think that's really a key to the successes that we have been having in recent months. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just a great panel. Questions or comments? Yes, Representative Girard, please.
One of the things I'm a little bit concerned about is the loss of manufacturing jobs. And one of you talked about the Betsy, the tax deferral for energy use. Could have any of you studied Senate Bill 638 and the impact that's going to have, and how if that's going to cost us jobs?
What Senate Bill 638?
Or
838,
sorry.
Utility renewable.
Oh, you can ask him. I'm the gas utility in Oregon.
Let me try to take a crack at that. Chair Witt, members of the committee, and Representative Gerard. I'd like to just sort of perhaps put at ease, or to put a little bit of a different spin on manufacturing dying in Oregon. I think that's sort of far from the truth. I think we've seen a decline in perhaps the traditional natural-based resource manufacturing kinds of jobs that we had here in our state in 1980. That's true. But the businesses that have stayed here in Oregon, that have survived, are prospering. They have gotten themselves up to global standards. They compete at the global marketplace, and they're doing very well, thank you very much. And I think they continue to do far better as we move forward. The other manufacturing businesses that we are attracting here to Oregon are in different spaces than perhaps what we've seen in the past, and I think that will add to the richness and the diversity of these businesses. The key that we hear, and I'm on the board of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition, I believe they've come and spoken to this committee as well in the past, is the large looming retirements from the workforce. There are a number of folks that are very high-skilled, very talented workers that are perhaps baby boomers that are about to think about other choices in their lifestyles. How to keep that intellectual property going, I think, and keep it in Oregon, I think, is probably going to be far more important an issue. Now, as it comes to, you know, some of the other issues on that particular bill and other places, those are choices that I think we're going to have to make as we go along. They're going to be trade-offs, but it's not only the cost of a particular product, whether it's electricity or anything else. I think you need to think about price as an important issue, but there are other issues about diversity in suppliers, or in this case, diversity in supply. We can talk about predictability of prices, the stability of prices, and a number of other issues whether you have those factors, the factors that affect price increases within your control or outside of your control. Those are all elements in the risk assessment that one goes through when one is running a business. And I think those are all considerations that ultimately affect how Oregon stacks up in the regional economic development picture.
Representative Holby, this is probably going to have to be the last question, committee members, because we have a session here at 10.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and notwithstanding that, since we have and to follow up on Representative Girard's line of questioning, since we have a couple of energy gurus here, we've talked a lot about, shovel-ready land, buildable land and infrastructure being available, and we've talked about a skilled workforce, availability of that. I got a question specifically I've been following for a couple of years, and it has to do with energy, and it has to do with our transmission constraints. And do you see that as somehow being something that will solve itself, or is it something that the state really needs to be proactive and working with utilities and the BPA and natural gas for that respect to as well, and really trying to get out and solve some of these energy constraints that potentially could keep development from happening in Oregon?
Chairwood, members of the committee, Representative Holby, I think utilities is just another tool in Oregon's economic development arsenal, whether it's existing businesses that we're trying to keep here or new ones that we're trying to bring here. And transmission lines are nothing more different than water lines. There are issues there. I think it was Mr. Repine that started off this morning saying that we are at the edge of many of the infrastructure investments we made 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we're at a point where I believe the next round of investments need to occur. And this is for all of us to address to. And transmission lines and natural gas pipelines and water lines, highways, all of that are all part of that picture. Is that for us to take it to the next step as we look at the next 20, 30 years of our state? We're at that point where we have to make those hard decisions.
I guess I'll try and answer the question, part electric and then maybe natural gas. In our Washington, Idaho electric service territories, we are making huge investments in transmission, replacing, older facilities, trying to meet growing demand. For instance, on the way from Spokane to Lewiston, we put in a transmission line on some property we bought, I think, 40 or 50 years ago, and now we're being sued. And I think that utilities are constantly being hit with, those types of issues, because nobody wanted to see the transmission line. And I'm not sure how we're going to serve a growing community if we can't put the infrastructure in place that we've got to do. What would the state's role be in cooperating with the utility or BPA? I know our utility, for instance, we share some interconnection, and our own transmission upgrades are done in cooperation with BPA in facilities out in Idaho. I guess I would have to say, be careful what obstacles policymakers throw in front of utilities from being able to serve any kind of utility, whether it's electric, gas, water. I think that some of those things can create some problems. As far as the gas side, we're an underground utility, so we tend to not have the same problems, and a lot of transmission is owned by international pipeline companies or interstate pipeline companies as well. I guess I would say the same thing. I know that down in Southern Oregon, the proposed line from Coos Bay down to California, I've heard local people say that 800 houses would be taken out in the city of Eagle Point. Well, I don't think that had ever happened, because just that kind of combination would, I think, double the cost, just double the cost of the project itself. And I don't think any transmission company in their right mind would want to go and increase their project cost by 100%. And so I guess I'd say the same thing with regard to, you know, state cooperation. Is what are the impediments that are put in place, and how does that constrain the utility's ability to continue to serve its expanding customer base? I don't have anything specific policy to point to. I hope that answers your question.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your testimony. It was very informative. And Charlie, I want to tell you that you made my day here with your comments. So, with that, I'm going to end the informational hearing today. Thank you again, very, very much, gentlemen. Ellen, could you review for us Wednesday's agenda, please, briefly?
Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, on Wednesday, May 9th at 8 a.m. here in Hearing Room C, you all will be having another informational meeting entitled The Lure of Oregon, Case Studies in Business Location and Expansion, and that's invited testimony to be announced.
Thank you very much. And with that, our committee's adjourned.